War Room Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to War Room Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon. I'm Raheem Kassam and the great Jason Miller. Here out of the Capitol Hill studios, the Breitbart Embassy, our very own skiff. It is Monday, the 28th of October, the year of our Lord 2019. Jason and I sitting here in Capitol Hill. We got Stephen K. Bannon in New York on assignment, fresh off of Fox News this morning. Going to be a busy show today. I hope you guys can keep up. Many things to discuss, not least the big news out of the White House yesterday that the President of the United States announcing the killing of the ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who he says ran into a dead-end tunnel, crying, whimpering, and screaming, portraying a pretty ignoble picture, I think, of the Washington Post venerated ISIS leader. I think I want to bring Jason in on that in just a second. Steve, up there in New York, can you hear us all good?
Yeah, I hear it's perfect. This is episode 8 of the War Room. So we start our second week today, and I want to thank all our listeners on the John Fredericks Radio Network for War Room and Impeachment. Yeah, I think a lot went on yesterday. Guys, the Washington Post's first headline was austere, what was it, austere Islamic cleric? Or
scholar?
Austere. Scholar.
Yeah, it was, I mean, how does this fit into the impeachment process? What does this talk about policy? What does it talk about President Trump being commander-in-chief? I noticed in the New York Times today, just saying in the front section of the paper, the one article on impeachment was back in the tire ads, I think on A12, which I think tells you everything you need to know if the president just does his day job of being commander-in-chief and the president of the United States.
Yeah, Jason.
Yeah, and Steve, fantastic work on Fox and Friends this morning, really laying things out. As we've been talking about the last couple days here about tightening up this elevator pitch, the number one thing that's most important that we want to communicate is this impeachment fight is really about President Trump's America First foreign policy. And what we've seen from Speaker Pelosi over the past 24 hours or so really is making our point for us. I mean, the fact that Speaker Pelosi is going after the president and trying to undermine and discount the significance of our getting al-Baghdadi, I think is really a tell here. This is what this is all about. And the fact that the media has tried to not give this as much attention as it should be getting, I think also tells you a lot also. So this is so critical, and this plays exactly into what we've been saying.
I mean, all they're talking about this morning, or they're trying to shift the conversation about how I think the New York Times on its front page said that actually President Trump's policies with the Kurds made this a more dangerous operation, and they're already talking about, oh well, Baghdadi's dead, but he hasn't been seen from in a while. There's going to be other followers. You know, people forget that President Trump in his inauguration address talked about creating new alliances, rejuvenating old alliances to eradicate radical Islamic terrorism from the face of the earth, starting with the destruction of the physical caliphate of ISIS, which at one time under Obama's presidency was a more functional state than Syria or Iraq. I mean, this is what President Trump, this is what America First was focused on, was it?
Yeah, and Steve, I mean, to put the a finer point on it, I mean, even look at Axios this morning. I mean, they're literally, their number one headline out of the gate is the Baghdadi raid dependent on ties Trump scoffs at. So here we have one of the most important foreign policy developments that we've seen of the Trump administration, and there's already this coordinated effort to try to undercut him and take him down.
So how do you think this plays this week as far as the witnesses go, as far, because once again, and you saw Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends. I really want to thank the people at Fox for having me on Fox and Friends this morning. I think Kilmeade did a great job. In fact, I will be on Brian's radio show on WABC later in the morning, I think at 11 o'clock, to drill down on this more in depth. You know, how does this play with the witnesses that we're going to have this week? Because, Raheem, once again, isn't this getting in really to the foreign policy, the State Department, National Security Council, Secretary of Defense area?
Yeah, I kind of thought I was going mad at the beginning of last week when we started this thing, and I really started to go through all of this stuff, and then we had the Taylor testimony, all that. And what stuck out to me was that, hey, who are these people that are going after Trump? Who are these people saying things about him and what he did on that phone call with President Zelensky, and why are they doing it? And digging and digging and digging, all that becomes clear, the one key thing, the one common thread throughout this whole thing, is that these are people who fundamentally disagree with the way President Trump does business on the world stage. These are people who thought that the Obama attitude towards Ukraine, i.e. taking it into the European Union, marching NATO troops up to the Russian border, removing its buffer state status. I mean, remember, we had regime change in Ukraine in 2013, sponsored by the EU, sponsored by the US. We had regime change. These are people, and the same thing you see with Syria, who fundamentally just disagree on policy. They don't think the president has done anything illegal. They don't think there are any high crimes and misdemeanors. They don't think there are any abuses of power. They just happen to believe that he's wrong in his foreign policy approach. And as I said to you, Steve, the other day, there's a small cadre of people who are leading, whether it's inadvertently or whether it's overtly, the impeachment of an elected president of the United States over what amounts to nothing more in what fiscal policy terms would be a 3 or 4% distinction on the top rate of income tax, right? It's not like the U.S. is saying, hey, nuts to Ukraine, you know, you're going to be invaded by Russia and we're not going to do anything about it. That would be a radical policy proposal that you would understand that people would get het up about. This is about small tinkering around the edges to draw back from U.S. overt U.S. involvement in places where, you know, you spent trillions of dollars, years upon years upon years of foreign interventions, foreign wars, foreign interference in other people's elections, and President Trump saying, no, you know what, maybe we're not an empire. Maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should respect the rights to self-determination of other nation states. Maybe tribal conflicts should be allowed to play out without our troops having to die for these things. And this is what the political establishment loathes, Steve.
I mean, Jason, isn't Raheem's argument to the heart of this? I mean, you've had, you know, President Trump continues to focus on the $7 trillion, and that's from Brown University's Watson Center. That's not from Breitbart. That's not from Town Hall. You know, that's not from, it's not from War Room Impeachment. That's not from a bunch of center-right or right-wing news sites. This is a progressive university. Brown University's Watson Center says $7 trillion was spent in the Middle East since 2001 on these wars. These endless foreign wars that the president is now focused with America First to kind of reorder. You know, if you think about China and you think about what he's trying to do in the Middle East and kind of reorganize and bring our allies in here to share the burden, not protectorates, but bring the allies in. You know, Ukraine was a sideshow and kind of this whole debate about the weapons, the foreign policy, and the shipping of the military assistance, which ultimately got shipped. It's just about the timing, about the corruption, about EU allies stepping up like he wants them to step up in Syria. I mean, this is what this debate, this is what it's going to come down about, judgment calls around foreign policy that the, and I don't want to call them the deep state, but the permanent bureaucracy supported under President Obama. They were failed policies in the Middle East during Obama's reign, and by the way, put to him by Bush, failed policies of the D.C. elitist, and this is what President Trump is fighting, and all of a sudden they're trying to raise this to an impeachable offense.
Steve, you're exactly right. I mean, this is fundamentally an attack on President Trump's America First foreign policy. And to your point about the folks who are going up the Hill this week, as we talk about Alexander Vindman, as we talk about Catherine Wheelbarger and folks that you've never heard of and probably never will again, obviously, Timothy Morrison and others. These folks, as we've discussed, I don't think the right way to go about it is to attack them and say that they're bad people, because all these people have, whether it's Ivy League or military records or backgrounds, they're doing this out in the open. And keep in mind, these are the same folks who, as collectively, are the same ones who sent us into the Middle East, sent us into Iraq, authorized what then became $7 trillion worth of expenditures going into the disaster in the Middle East. That's obviously, we're still feeling the impacts of it today. But these folks need to be called out for their records. They're sometimes 10, 20, 30-year records of pushing this globalist agenda and wanting us to spend money and be the world's cops, to be the world's welfare checks. And that is their fundamental worldview. And they can still be good people. I mean, I'm sure that they pay their taxes and they're nice to their neighbors and such, but they're wrong. They're dead wrong. History is going to show that they're wrong. And thank goodness President Trump is trying to change that.
Well, and this is the point. This is about they're all about democracy and overturning Democrats. I mean, President Trump was elected by the people of the United States in the early morning hours of November 9th. 2016, it was called for President Donald Trump by the Associated Press. He's President of the United States. He's Commander-in-Chief. He had a certain vision and a certain philosophy that he wanted to implement called America First. And this is not America in retreat from the world. This is not America's isolationist. This is America where when it's in the vital national security interest of the United States, it will be in the vital national security of our regional allies, and he's trying to get people to act like allies. That's why he wants more NATO involvement in Syria. That's why he wanted, in this whole situation in Ukraine, his first question was, how much is the EU, to Raheem's point, and Raheem was there in 2013, as he talked about yesterday on the show. Where is the EU? Where is Europe? Where is NATO in this? Where is their money? How's that coming in? What's about the corruption? What about all the stealing that's going on there? So what you're going to see, and I have no problem if people in the system debate that and say, hey, here's how you do it, or maybe this is not the right way to do it, or here's my idea. That's all what I call normal course of business. But these things are, don't even raise to the level of impeachable offense. And here you have the Democrats are going to force the country into a constitutional crisis, as Rifkin laid out on Saturday's show. We're going to be forced into a constitutional crisis over the holidays.
You're listening to War Room Impeachment. This is Episode 8 with Stephen K. Bannon, Raheem Kassam, Jason Miller. Jason and I live from the Capitol Hill Breitbart Embassy, our very own skiff down here, Stephen K. Bannon up in New York. Steve and Jason, I just want to bring that back now to, you know, we've discussed at the beginning of last week, when we kicked off this show, we discussed what's the elevator pitch, right? What is the pushback from the Republicans? At the time, by the way, let's remind everyone, messaging-wise, there was no pushback. Legal, there was no pushback. There was very little communication going on between the White House and the Republicans on Capitol Hill and the RNC and all of those guys. That has changed over the last week. This was the week that everything changed, and it desperately needed to. I think you saw a lot more an aggressive media strategy when the president went up yesterday and ate into all of that time on the Sunday shows. A pretty Machiavellian strategy, if you ask me. Worked pretty well. But what's the elevator pitch now? I want to ask Jason and throw it to Steve.
Yeah, and so this is very tight. It's very concise. If you're a supporter of President Trump's out there and you're wondering, how do we go and get beyond just talking about the process, here it is. Number one, the impeachment fight is about President Trump's America First foreign policy. It's a policy dispute being driven by unelected career bureaucrats combined with politically motivated Capitol Hill Democrats seeking to undermine President Trump's foreign policy. Number two, the facts are our friends here. All witness testimony thus far shows President Trump did nothing wrong, and he certainly didn't do what he's being accused of doing, as the Ukraine aid wasn't withheld. You wouldn't get this from the selective media leaks carried on by Speaker Pelosi that we see on the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post or CNN 24 hours a day. Right. And this is why everything should be open and transparent so that people can hear the truth. Number three, the Democrats' impeachment push is unconstitutional. And constitutional law scholars, we had one of them on the show on Saturday, say Capitol Hill Democrats' efforts are completely unconstitutional since they haven't taken a House vote to even begin proceedings. In fact, these same scholars argue there shouldn't be any subpoenas or any hearings until this vote is held. So those are the very three concise points.
So let's put those in buckets. So you have precedent, which is about the Constitution. You have policy, which is about this policy debate about America First, which is fine. And then you have process about what Matt Gaetz and folks last week tried to expose about this secret star chamber process. That's the basic three elements of this: precedent, policy, and process.
I think that's absolutely right. And Steve, when it comes to fighting back against this over the course of the next week, 2 weeks. I mean, they're talking now as if they're going to delay this process. And in the next segment, we're also going to get into, you know, the legal aspects, the legal fightbacks by people like Charles Kupperman, who was supposed to be testifying this morning, but is waiting on a judicial ruling as a result. Steve, we've got, I believe, Scott Rasmussen joining us in the next hour as well, in the next half an hour as well, rather, in order to help us break down some of this on polling and messaging and things like that. But when you look at the three things that Jason and you just laid out, policy, precedent, and process, where do you guys think this administration needs to start? We're at the top of the week. What should be the number one priority for them?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to, and again, whether this is the White House specifically or whether these are allies on the outside such as ourselves, we need to start deconstructing the bios and the backgrounds of these witnesses that are coming up to Capitol Hill. They want to hide in the tall grass or hide behind Speaker Pelosi and Adam Schiff.
You mean Nancy Pelosi had that Truth Exposed document that we were talking about at the beginning of last week, and have we seen anything similar from the Republicans at this point?
No.
Why?
There's nothing. But I think Republicans have been slow, very slow, out of the gate to go and come up with this message and start getting around it. But what we've seen in this past week, whether it's our Capitol Hill allies, AGs, number of folks, even the White House starting to ramp up and take this seriously, I'm hoping we will see that soon. But number one, we need to go and make some of these folks famous and break down their entire careers. And let's look at it from our perspective, not on the selective leak Nancy Pelosi perspective that you're going to see every morning on the TV shows. I think the other thing that we really need to do and get out there is, and we've been saying this all along, our constitutional law allies, our legal allies, need to get off the sidelines and get into the game. We saw Republican AGs with an uptick. Where are all the Federalist Society folks? I mean, do they not realize that if President Trump were to be impeached and he's not reelected in 2020, they're not getting any Supreme Court picks over the next 4 to 8 years? And so the same way you rushed out.
Well, also, I think that in regards to this and the Federalist Society and the other great supporters of President Trump, the constitutional lawyers, this Kupperman situation, I think, you know, I'm just quoting Judge Luttig, who was considered on the short list for the Supreme Court and one of the best conservative judges out there. He said that this, he believes, will be the most significant case about separation of powers maybe ever argued before the Supreme Court. So these are massive constitutional issues, and you're absolutely right, Jason. We need our top legal scholars piling into this now, and really to confront the Democrats on the radical nature of the Lawrence tribes, and these guys are trying to get a fast train here to impeachment.
And Steve, just to put a final point then on to Raheem's question about what we need to do this week, if I were in the White House, I would say, President Trump, let's get out there and make a speech about America First foreign policy.
Yes.
and directly push back on these unelected career bureaucrats who are challenging it. Let's have President Trump, because he has the hot hand right now.
Yes.
He just got Baghdadi. He has all of the energy and the juice and the momentum on foreign policy on his side. So let's go out there and let's go and make this call it out for what it is. This is an assault on America First foreign policy. It's an assault on what the American people voted for, and we're not going to take it anymore.
Let's take the last item of process, because the three verticals, the three lanes here are precedent about the Constitution, policy about America First foreign policy and the debate even within the apparatus, the national security apparatus. And the last is process. You know, Raheem over the weekend drilled down, he's been drilling down and going through at least the testimony we have. Mark Meadows, remember, Mark Meadows has sat through 70 hours of this. Mark Meadows said he has not heard one thing about a quid pro quo, and he hasn't heard anything in any testimony that he wouldn't like to make public that he thinks would exonerate the president. It's in the details. The most important thing, one of the most important things you said today, Jason, is that the details are our friend. Matt Gaetz, I think, broke the fever last week by going down and showing that, hey, in this secret star chamber where Schiff is, it's just selective leads, selective tweets, selective headlines, selective guests on mainstream media. The conservatives understand the details are our friends here. The more granular you get, the better it looks for President Trump.
I also want to raise the fact that I think Jason's onto a real winner with the idea that President Trump should be giving a foreign policy speech to double down on the America First foreign policy agenda, and the reason is this. You know, I'm
I think he gave a foreign policy speech on Saturday night when he authorized the use of lethal force.
He died like a dog.
Let's do one every single day this
exactly.
week, then, Steve.
And he reiterated that he was a sniveling coward, right? That died like a dog, right, on Sunday morning.
Look, when it comes to Taylor's testimony, there were some key tells in there, I think. And ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't join us over the weekend, make sure you catch up. It's warroom.org and catch up with the shows from this weekend, especially because people didn't seem to realize Phil Rieker, the Eurasian Affairs guy who was in there yesterday, on Saturday, people thought he'd be in there a couple of hours, maybe light testimony. The guy was in there for nearly 9 hours on a Saturday. That is a grueling amount of time to spend anywhere in the vicinity of Adam Schiff, quite frankly, let alone in front of him answering any questions. But I want to bring it back to Taylor's testimony real quick, because the tell in Taylor's testimony is when, for the first two pages, he yammers on about how much he loves Ukraine, how much he loves the country, how much he fell in love with it, how much he likes sitting on the board of a Ukrainian NGO. He says Ukraine is special to me. He goes on and talks about accepting the offer to go and serve as the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires or acting ambassador in Ukraine. And he overtly says in his testimony that he was only willing to do it if there was no real change in policy.
Boom.
Under the Trump administration. That is the tell, right? Of these guys, they don't believe, as we said this weekend, they don't believe that the president sets policy. They believe they set policy.
I do have a question for Mike Pompeo. Did that not come up in the interview with Ambassador Taylor? And we're not going to denigrate Ambassador Taylor. Look, he was a West Point grad, fought in Vietnam with the 101st 82nd Airborne, 50 years dedication to the country. On this one, I think he's dead wrong. But did that ever come up, Jason, in his interview with Mike Pompeo hired him. Wouldn't it come up that, hey, I'm only taking the job if we stick with this policy? Well, oh, by the way, Ambassador Taylor, we're actually going to have a policy that's totally different than the Obama policy.
Steve, to answer your question, a quote from Ambassador Taylor's testimony on page 3, and not to pile in on Pompeo or anything, but and we don't know how true this is, but I'll just read this from you. During my meeting with Secretary Pompeo on May 28th, I made clear to him and others present that if U.S. policy towards Ukraine changed, he would not want me posted there, and I could not stay.
And Steve, I mean, this goes back to even when worked on the campaign or on the transition team and talking to folks about coming on to work for President Trump. Question number one is always, are you willing to carry forth with the president's agenda, or tell me what from his policy you want to get behind, or what makes you want to support President Trump? If all these foreign affairs folks coming on board aren't willing to support what President Trump was elected to do, then get the hell out.
Steve, we have to pay some bills, Jason, here.
You know President Trump. Steve. President Trump likes having debate. Look, that's why he had Gary Cohen and myself and others. He likes having debates with his staff, you know, on ideas. But he's got this America First foreign policy is something he's really thought through. He doesn't mind if you come in and argue on the margins, but the central drive of it, right? Like, we're going to destroy the physical caliphate of ISIS, and we're going to get people that are going to send troops and give money and be allies. The same thing in Ukraine that, hey, we don't really support the way this thing's been handled in the past, and particularly we're just not going to be, Jason, you know better than anybody, his thoughts on foreign aid and military aid. We're not going to be shipping dollars to people, right, unless our other allies are throwing money into the kitty. And we know that all these dollars from American taxpayers are actually going to be spent on what it's supposed to be spent for and not ripped off by a bunch of oligarchs in places like Ukraine.
Right. Steve, we've got to pay some bills here on the John Fredericks Network. This is War Room Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, Raheem Kassam out of both Washington, D.C. and New York. Go to a quick break. We'll be back with Scott Rasmussen, Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller.
War Room Impeachment. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome back to War Room Impeachment. It's Monday, the 28th of October, the year of our Lord, 2019. This is episode 8 of the brand new War Room Impeachment show with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, myself, Raheem Kassam. Jason and I broadcasting out of the Capitol Hill studio. Steve on assignment in New York, just off Fox and Friends. The clip from that interview will be live on the warroom.org website momentarily. I want to thank the John Fredericks Network for hosting us here for our 8th episode. I want to throw it to Stephen K. Bannon in New York. Now we've got Scott Rasmussen on the line, I believe, already hot and ready to go. Steve, over to you.
Yeah, so here's this is important. I think what we're trying to do is get the key guest in this impeachment process. We start with Mark Meadows. We then went to Congressman Matt Gaetz. We then had David Rifkin about his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal on the constitutionality. So we were taking each one, Meadows about the process. About the policy. It was Gaetz about the process. It was Rifkin versus the precedent. So all three of the first guests were about these verticals that we think is very important to kind of get the elevator pitch of how we combat and stop Nancy Pelosi's political disinformation warfare campaign against the President of the United States that's going to force us into a constitutional crisis. The next element is Scott Rasmussen. And quite frankly, John Fredericks, when I did the interview with him, myself, other people, people have been lulled to sleep on this. I kept saying, hey, this is important. It was Scott Rasmussen's poll that came out that had it at 50%. Scott Rasmussen, folks, and this, you know this from Jason Miller, who ran communications, who's my co-host along with Raheem here on the War Room Impeachment. Jason and myself would always say it's Rasmussen that's got the most sophisticated polling about the Trump base. So Scott, thanks, welcome to the show. Can you tell us what your polling showed, particularly that poll you had that 50% of the American people thought it was appropriate to both impeach and remove from office President Trump?
We may still be trying to get Scott connected there. I know he was on the line.
Okay,
well, a moment
I
got ago.
I can now hear you. I hear you.
So Scott, you're the number one.
Reiterate that.
You're the number one pollster of the Trump base, and your poll that came out to 50%, the one that shocked us into reality. Can you walk people through what this polling's saying right so far about this political disinformation campaign that Nancy Pelosi's running?
Well, the first thing it tells us is that a lot of people who are supporters of President Trump don't want to believe it. You put out a number saying 50% of voters think the president should be impeached and removed. And the first thing I hear is, oh, it's fake news. It's fake polls. You've got to face the reality. There is some level of public support for this. Now, we also have to be a little realistic about where it comes from. Before the president took office, about one out of three voters said that he wasn't legitimately elected. He only won because of the Russians or because of something else. These people have wanted the president impeached from day one. Over the last year or so, that number grew a little bit into the low 40% range with all the Russian stories and the special counsel investigations. And in the last month, it has jumped up. But it's jumping among one segment of the population, Democrats. Right now, 84% of Democrats believe the president should be impeached and removed from office. This is a huge jump in the last. It's become the official position of the Democratic Party, and it's something that all Democratic voters, or just about all Democratic voters, buy into at some level. On the flip side, 75% of Republicans are opposed to the idea. Only 14% support it. And independents, they're stuck in the middle. They're bouncing back. Right now, a slight plurality favor impeachment removal, but if that number moves. So what we're seeing, I think, is a setup a little bit like we saw in the Kavanaugh hearings from a year ago, where you're going to have two partisan sides going at it and not listening to the other. And again, the danger right now is that one side of the debate, the supporters of President Trump, just aren't believing it's happening.
Well, Scott and Jason, I definitely want you to jump in here. I know you know polling better than just about anybody knows. Scott, here's what's got me concerned. When you just say right there, 14% of Republicans, or only 75% now think he shouldn't be, but 14% think he should. Nancy Pelosi's only been on this for a month. I mean, she started this, I think, on September 24th. What's the trend, and particularly among independents? I think those are disturbing numbers. I think this shows you the lack of messaging coming out by Trump's allies and people that support both President Trump and his policy is disturbing. Where do we stand with independents and Republicans?
Right now, the trends are disturbing. Immediately after the special counsel report came out, support among independents for the idea of impeachment fell dramatically. A majority of independents said that they opposed the idea of impeaching the president and removing him from office. Now we're at a point where 46% favor impeachment and removal, 37% are opposed. Among Republicans, there has always been a group of around 8% who thought the president should be removed from office. The numbers have jumped up a little bit. Again, if I could go back to the Kavanaugh comparison, because I think it is a similar dynamic. When the first charges came out against Brett Kavanaugh, his numbers dropped, and support among Republicans wavered a little bit. A few people said, no, he shouldn't be confirmed. There were a lot of undecideds. Over time, most of them came back because Brett Kavanaugh had a positive defense of his character and his record, and he had a lot of support. So that does go right to your messaging theme.
And Scott, this is Jason Miller here. I want to jump in with two questions for you. One following up on what you just said there, which is the following up on the Republicans and independents, and I guess even Democrats in particular, how you see this, granted, it's very early, but how you see it impacting turnout as we head into next year. And the second question I have for you is probably the most underreported polling story over this past week was the Harry Enten write-up with for CNN.com, where he broke it down that this is actually the impeachment push is not popular in all the swing states, the places where Democrats need to go and win. And what your thoughts are on any trends to that effect or what that overall impact is going to have for the places that ultimately will decide the presidency in 2020.
Well, first off, I think on the turnout question, we're going to see most likely record-setting turnout. From the beginning of the Trump presidency, it has been widely assumed that Democrats and the president's opponents were going to turn out in droves, that they didn't expect this to happen and things were going to change in 2020. As we look to the future, right now, I think the Republicans' turnout is also going to be greater than anybody expected. So I think we're heading towards a high turnout level, and I believe that the higher the impeachment discussion goes, the better that is for GOP turnout, provided there's an awareness that it's a real issue. Now, when you talk about the swing states, absolutely right. You know, you're in a situation where Republicans are uniting against impeachment. You start talking about swing states. These are not, you know, Michigan and Pennsylvania are not Republican-leaning states by any stretch of the imagination, but they're also not California or New York. And these are states where rural voters are fed up. They want to hear people talking about issues. They want to see things move forward. And they viscerally react to defend the president because they don't believe or don't trust the other side. There's a group that I've identified called the movable middle. These are people that don't have a strong position for one side or the other. And by the way, just to give you a sense of this, one out of four voters say they don't think things would be all that much different if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016. So this group in the middle, a little bit detached from the process, open to shifting their vote, open to deciding whether to turn out and vote or not. They lean against impeachment, and even more, they think impeachment is very unlikely to happen, so there's a sense of it being a little bit of a waste of time. But, you know, you talk about these things. This is a living situation. This is a vibrant debate. Steve mentioned how Nancy Pelosi has been pushing this, and yes, if there is not strong messaging to counter it, these people in the middle, these undecided voters, are going to eventually reach their own conclusion, and without one side entering the debate, it's pretty easy to see which way they go.
Scott, before we let you go, just once again, when are you back in the field to update? Because your 50% poll, I got to tell you, was like a fire bell in the night, I think, to people that understand the Trump movement, the people that support the president and his agenda. That was a fire bell. That was, to me, hey, I told John Fredericks, we got have to go to general quarters. With Scott Rasmussen says 50% of the American people are comfortable with impeachment process, inquiry, and removing him from office. When are you going to go back into the field and come back with some more analysis that shows if the Matt Gaetz, Mark Meadows, what we've been doing, other people, if it's starting to have any impact?
We'll be back in the field within a couple of weeks. Don't know the exact date right now, but it is something that we will track regularly going forward. I mean, this is, I mentioned the Kavanaugh fight for a very specific reason. That shut down everything in Washington. As this goes forward, we could be seeing another situation where everything else gets shut down. There is no room to move an agenda. There will be impeachment, trial, and election, and that will be all that happens in 2020.
Scott Rasmussen, one of the best pollers out there in the country and certainly the best keeping his fingers on the pulse of the Trump movement. Scott, thank you very much for joining us on War Room Impeachment.
Thank you.
Okay, Jason, I want to turn to you. We're running out of time. We've got a lot of wood to cut here. What's your takeaway from Scott Rasmussen's assessment?
Well, I think there's definitely some encouraging news in there, but also some real warning signs. I think the commentary about where turnout is going to be, I think that's exactly spot on. It's probably something that you don't hear about near as much. But we're going to be just in the exact same polarized type environment heading into 2020 that we had in 2016. But the 100% negative media flow that President Trump has been experiencing, largely driven by Speaker Pelosi's masterclass comms effort that she has going on, that's going to have an impact. And when you're subjected to 100% negative information flow, you're going to see numbers for Democrats and independents, their numbers as far as their moods on impeachment go up to an all-time high.
And you agree with Scott about, particularly about the analogy to the Kavanaugh situation. Do you agree that as we drive deeper into this process over the closer to Thanksgiving, the holiday season, on the inquiry and then the vote of impeachment and then the potential trial, do you think that sucks all the oxygen out of the air of everything else?
Absolutely, and I think that's what Democrats are going to do, is they're going to run this all the way up to the beginning of the Iowa caucus, which comes up, I believe it's February 3rd, right at the very beginning of February, for a couple reasons. Number one, their candidates are terrible. They don't really have anything to say. Number two, they don't want their candidates to be picked apart. Heading into the first round of Democratic primary voting, of course, media is going to start doing investigative pieces, but if that's all to the side, they'll just keep their pressure on Trump. And then also, the longer they can keep this negative information flow going toward President Trump, then the more that they're winning.
Raheem, let's go very quickly to what else. I know we have Nigel Farage, by the way, our guest tomorrow in studio with Jason and with Raheem is going to be Nigel Farage, the head of the Brexit movement. He's in Washington, D.C., I think, for one day. He's going to come into the war room. We're only having the most important guests, Meadows, Gates, Rivkin, Scott Rasmussen, and Nigel Farage tomorrow will be in to talk about how Brexit, how the established order there has shut down or tried to shut down the voice of the people, just like the established order in Washington, D.C. Raheem, what's happening today and over the next couple of days that the audience should be focused on?
Right, and I just, you know, I spoke with Nigel last night about this as well, and just to give the audience a preview, it's going to be a show that you definitely don't want to miss, because the as Steve always says, the nullification projects of what happened in 2016 on both sides of the Atlantic, the refutation and the rejection of the globalist, you know, order that they had thought was locked up for decades and decades is still going on. Brexit today been delayed until next January now, at the end of January now, the new announcement. So we're going to be hearing more about that tomorrow. Definitely not one you're going to want to miss. Over the course of this week, of course, we were supposed to have Charles Kupperman today, the former Deputy National Security Advisor, one of the very few who has actually challenge this legally and is waiting a judicial ruling on whether or not he needs to sit in front of Adam Schiff and talk. Alexander Vindman, national security expert on Ukraine, a very, very important person in this whole process. Alex Vindman, one of those people who had, I mean, very sort of integrally connected to all of this. We know his brother also at the NSC. There are water cooler moments that we hear about going on at the NSC being the things that kick this whole thing off. So it'll be interesting to hear what Alexander Vindman has to say. There have also been some new additions as well from what we discussed last week. Not just Catherine Wheelbarger from the Pentagon on Wednesday, but also Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson now scheduled to be.
So these are all mid-level policy people. to tee up. This is to tee up Pompeo, Bolton, and Mulvaney. They want all three of those. Jason, do you see, you know, as Raheem goes through this litany of kind of the working level people that are being called up here for questioning, do you see Pompeo, Mulvaney, or Mick Mulvaney or Pompeo or John Bolton coming forward and testifying?
Not anytime soon, and I think the other name that I wouldn't expect to see anytime soon is Mayor Giuliani. It was Mayor Giuliani, Pompeo, and Mulvaney who the Democrats wanted to get this week, and they're actually following the directions of the White House to not participate in this sham process and these closed-door proceedings with all these leaks and the whole unconstitutional nature. Again, without getting in the weeds, the whole thing is unconstitutional, as Rivkin laid out over the weekend here. But the big question, really, this Kupperman lawsuit, this is going to be such a massive precedent setter that there's going to be a lot of attention being paid to it.
Jason,
kind of a tell as well, Steve.
Yeah, do what, Raheem?
Kind of a tell that Kupperman's the only one who's gone this way. You know, it seems that the rest of them are quite happy to spill the beans. But, you know, people like Wheelbarger at the Pentagon, a former McCain staffer, John McCain staffer, in fact, political appointee, rather than a career bureaucrat there. And then Catherine Croft and Christopher Anderson, as you say, Steve, these are State Department Ukraine experts. So this is all going to come down to, and I, by the way, another prediction from me, I'm in the habit of making one every day now, another prediction from me, it's going to become apparent to the public very quickly that why are we in this whole mess because of Ukraine? You know, many people, including me until about 2013, couldn't pick out Ukraine on a map. Why is the United States and the President of the United States and the election in 2016 being nullified over some things that are sort of circulating around a very, very corrupt country?
It's a sideshow to a sideshow when you think about China and the Middle East and all that. Nigel Farage and Raheem know a lot about Ukraine, a lot about American policy back there in the early days. We'll have all that tomorrow. The CNN, I'm watching CNN here in New York on my screen. Jason, before we leave, you were at the game last night, the swamp. You know, CNN's got, you know, Trump was met by boos, met by lock him up. That was really the swamp, wasn't it? Isn't that a great tell for the president, a great support really for the people out there in the country that the swamp booed him?
And exactly, and I would lean into it. If I were the president, I'd go and tweet out something about the Houston Astros being absolute class acts and that he had a pleasure meeting them recently and hopes that they continue on. Now, obviously, just I'm 100% behind the Nationals, but I'm saying if I were advising the president on this, I'd say to make that point. But look, this is so silly. I mean, this is like having a national explosion over the fact of, let's say, Barack Obama went to Grand Rapids or Oklahoma City or Shreveport and was booed at a game. You'd never see the media go and turn this around.
It's top trend on Twitter right now, which sort of tells you what Twitter is, this echo chamber of liberals getting very excited that Trump got booed at a Nationals game. I mean, it's 90% liberals sitting in there.
And Steve, I can't tell you enough how, I mean, there are folks there who, I mean, it's the World Series. It's the final home game for the Nationals. And you had these, well, for lack of a better term, triggered losers who are standing in their seats, turning around and staring at the president's, at the box that he was in with Gates and David Perdue and other folks. Literally, the first two innings that he was there, they were standing and staring at them. I'm like, hey, guys, there's a game going on the field. You know, sit down. What's wrong with you guys? But it's these folks are so triggered. And you know what, Steve? They're the paper pushers from the fifth floor corner office of the Department of Education who are trying to lock down their pension and hoping there's another COLA increase.
Well, the Department of State, too. This is what I mean. Department this is kind of the revolt. It's the revolt of the unelected bureaucrats on policy differences, yes, that have triggered, and now the radical, yes, group of political warfare, information warfare over in Schiff's office, they think they actually can impeach a president of the United States over this. I mean, this is what's so ludicrous, and they're going to bear the burden of this because they're forcing the country into a constitutional crisis, and we're not focused on passing UMCA, we're not focused on passing prescription drugs, we're not doing the things to build the economy and do the things that help us with our trade deals because we're focused on that. That's what you saw in the, you know, President Trump's a Yankees fan. He went there yesterday to support the local team and the Houston Astros in the institution of baseball and the World Series.
Steve, I just want to, before we wrap, I want to just bring your attention and people's attention onto some of the other developments that that we can expect this week. There's been a lot of talk about the new White House communications, impeachment communications thing. CNN reporting that while Tony Saig is the only name out there at the moment, the former Treasury comms person, did a very, very good job over there. Saying that the President Trump still isn't keen on the idea of a war room and still hasn't signed off on such a thing. Do we have any inside baseball on that?
Well, I think, Jason, you probably know, but hey, when you get the outside war room on a war room impeachment, why do you need another, Jason?
Well, I think the way that we've seen allies step up over this past week is very refreshing. I'm glad to see it. I still think that they should pick Tony and get him plugged in there. I think he'd be the
Tony's
absolute
a huge
right
piece of,
choice.
He's a huge piece of manpower. Huge piece of manpower. Did a great job during the tax cut. And I know Stephanie Grisham and the group, they're doing a great job over in the comm shop. Jason, wouldn't you agree? You can always be augmented by other great personnel.
Yeah, and I want to make a point about Stephanie Grisham, the White House Communications Director. She's doing a fantastic job.
Yes.
And the way that she was mercilessly attacked over the weekend at a personal level, and the way that some of the networks, Morning Joe, for example, you'd think that a massive portion of their show this morning was attacking her personally. But it's physically impossible for one person to do four distinct different jobs. And we need to get Stephanie some additional bodies in there. There's some very good folks at the White House. We have some good direction. Now let's give them some additional help.
Okay, this is a War Room Impeachment. We'll return tomorrow, 9 a.m. to 10 on the John Frederick Radio Network. Nigel Farage will be a guest. If you're watching on Facebook, you'll see the stream of the Fox interview immediately after our broadcast for everybody watching on Facebook. I want to thank Raheem and Jason, John Frederick, the entire group. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow at 9 a.m.